This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. As we continue our effort to engage government executives who are changing the way government does business, we are here in New York City. This city, perhaps more than any other, represents a complex ecosystem that requires and consumes a vast array of natural resources. Protecting such resources and the environmental health and welfare of its residents is essential for New York City and all cities to exist and thrive. With us today to discuss his efforts in this area is our very special guest, Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. Cass, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Brian Lewis. Brian, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Cass, I'd like to start off by learning more about your department. Could you give us a history of the mission, function of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection?
Sure. The Department of Environmental Protection is today, the modern department is a collection of functions that have gradually been put together and pulled apart a little bit over time. The current department was started in 1977, I believe, and came out of – in the Lindsay administration, they put together the super agencies. So one of the agencies was the Environmental Protection Administration, I believe, and one function that was in there – that no longer is sanitation. So the department has always had water supply, sewage treatment. There was a time back in its history when we also had gas and electric on the theory that I think it's all utility. So probably from an efficiency point of view, you put it all in the ground at the same time. But it's been DEP since about 1977. But the history of the agency and the water supply for the city of New York goes back to the founding of the Manhattan Company in 1799, which was a private company. So the initial water supply was really a private monopoly or franchise that was granted to this company, and it was a banking company. So it's pretty interesting stuff.
What's the relationship with the folks in Albany, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation?
DEC is our primary regulator.
Okay.
And people – that's a – good question. People do – when I talk to them about what I do, they say, oh, so you're the Environmental Protection Agency for the city of New York. And the answer to that is not really. DEP is a utility. We are a water and wastewater utility primarily. There are a couple of other important quality of life functions that we handle and that are central to our mission, like air quality, noise quality, things that really are about the everyday environment and quality of life for New Yorkers. But the majority of our operating budget, our capital budget, our infrastructure, our personnel, the 6,000 people who work for the agency, that is about water supply and wastewater treatment. Now, it's clearly a heavily regulated area, as it should be. On the drinking water side, the State Department of Health is the primary regulator in terms of meeting drinking water quality standards. On the wastewater treatment side and the quality of the city's what they call ambient waters is with the State Department of Environmental Conservation. And the authority, that regulatory authority in most cases is delegated from the federal authority, which is the Environmental Protection Agency.
You mentioned the fact that you're actually a utility in some capacity and the scale of operations at DEP. Could you give us a sense? You mentioned 6,000 employees. How is it organized, the size of your budget and more particularly the size of your portfolio in terms of mains, tunnels, aqueducts and just the whole thing that you manage?
Well, it's pretty amazing. The agency has 6,000 employees. We supply about 1 billion gallons of drinking water every day to New Yorkers, 8 million in the city and 1 million who are just outside the city and in some upstate counties and towns. And that all happens through about 6,600 miles of aqueducts, tunnels, and water mains. The water comes from as far away as 125 miles in the Catskill-Delaware watershed upstate. And then it comes into the Kensico Reservoir. And I won't go through all the distribution channels, but the primary channel right now is into Kensico, then into the Hillview Reservoir in Yonkers, which is right over the city line. And from there, it gets fed into city water tunnels number 1, 2, and 3, where it's carried to the distribution network of mains under the streets. Once you take a drink at your tap or brush your teeth or whatever else, take a shower, then you're in the sewer system. You're in the collection system in the terms of the people, you know, our sewage treatment workers and the wastewater treatment side of the business. There are 7,400 miles of sewer mains in New York City, and they carry the 1.3 billion gallons of wastewater that New Yorkers produce every day to one of 14 wastewater treatment plants. And each of those plants is a major industrial operation. So when I think about the agency operations, it's really supply, which comes from our 19 reservoirs, distribution, which are those 6,600 miles of water mains and 7,400 miles of sewer mains, and then treatment, the 14 wastewater treatment plants. And then there is the other operating division, if you will, is our capital division. Our Bureau of Engineering, Design, and Construction, they build and maintain the city's sewer, water, and wastewater infrastructure. So it's big.
So what are your official responsibilities, and more particularly, what's a week or a day in the life of a commissioner?
The top three responsibilities I have are, first, to deliver clean drinking water and to treat wastewater to the appropriate standards so that our receiving water is where the effluent, the treated water from our wastewater treatment plants ultimately goes back into the surrounding waters around New York City. The second priority and responsibility is to do this all in a way that's sustainable and meet the mayor's sustainability goals. And then number three, tying one and two together, I have to do all of that as cost efficiently as possible at the lowest possible cost so that the New Yorkers, the 834,000 customers, rate payers, if you will, who pay the water bills, pay as little as possible for the best service.
So in a sense, you're providing a service like most utilities, the concept, but you're also protecting that vital asset, which is water.
Correct.
That's coming in clean, good, healthy, probably one of the best drinking waters in the world, and that's your job.
Yes, I certainly agree with that. It's one of the best in the world. And in terms of delivering that 1 billion gallons, that has to meet water quality standards. And to ensure that that happens, our Division of Water Quality conducts more than 500,000 tests a year. So at any given time, there are people out testing water quality, and I get updates on certain tests and so forth. And so I'm very plugged into that side, but as well as the wastewater side. Wastewater treatment is a complicated, energy intensive business, and it's but we have some of the best workers anywhere doing that work all throughout our agency. So I would say I'm very lucky in the sense that I have a very strong set of managers who have been involved in water and wastewater for a long time, and so far it's been great.
So, Commissioner, in the context of your responsibilities and duties, What are the top three challenges that you face in your position, and how are you addressing these challenges?
I think number one is performance measurement at the agency. DEP clearly does a good job. People turn on the tap, the water comes out. The water also goes away, and it tastes great. So in a sense, we're doing great by that measure. But one of the things that we're building at DEP now is a new Office of Strategic Planning that is putting together a comprehensive set of metrics across those four core areas that I talked about. Because it's not just enough to break things down into your management buckets, but also then to say, well, what are my goals within this area? Then how are we going to get there? So I'm taking a very methodical approach to defining those things with the ultimate goal of to help you drive decision-making across the agency, because resources are limited. And in order to prioritize, you really have to have the whole picture. Challenge number two, our capital program is huge. We have right now $11 billion in construction. We have $3 billion in design. We do some very complicated work, and we have to do all our projects with our wastewater treatment plants while we keep the plants running. You can't shut down and go to divert flow to another plant, so that drives up cost and it makes it more complicated. But we do it. I think there is some opportunity to bring some more discipline to our project design and execution process. So that's a huge challenge. Third, operating efficiency. I think one thing that I saw coming into the agency, there was to a certain degree silos, operating silos that I wanted to break down. Part of the issue with it is people don't take advantage of resources. People also get it in their mind that those resources are their resources, and that's not the case. They're the agency's resources, and we have to figure out how best to allocate them. But as a matter of really trying to leverage the expertise across the agency, before I came in the first day, was we started taking down the walls on the top floor to build a bullpen. I brought all the senior managers up, and we're all sitting in a room together. Rather than waiting and setting up a meeting and taking an interminable amount of time, maybe you forget about it. It's not as important. You can deal with things right away in that kind of environment. The final challenge, the agency's relationship with its regulators and our stakeholders. I think for a long time the attitude was, well, you can only get something done with DEP if you sue us. The mayor's philosophy on that is, you know, if you're litigating, you've lost. Usually you can come up with a better deal, more cost effective, and something that's going to maintain operating flexibility if you negotiate in the context of all your competing demands. And so one of the first things we announced in February was an agreement with the Natural Resources Defense Council and stakeholders in Jamaica Bay to make $115 million of investments in nitrogen reduction over the next 10 years. Now, there are standards, and that could have been embodied in a consent order that we litigated over 5 years, during which time God knows how many resources would be wasted getting to that result, and then you end up with something that just ties your hands.
Prior to your leadership of DEP, you've been involved in a number of important initiatives for the city, spanning health impact of September 11, 2001, terrorist attacks, and implementation of the city's solid waste management plan. Would you tell us a little more about yourself and describe your career path for our listeners? What brought you to your current role?
Sure. Well, I came to New York City right after college, and I came to the New York City Parks Department. And I worked for then Parks Commissioner Henry Stern. What I learned in that job was, first, a love for New York City. I'm originally from the suburbs of Philadelphia. This is to understand the history of the city and those public spaces, parks, was a really informative experience. But then as soon as you learn about parks, you learn about Robert Moses. As soon as you learn about Robert Moses, you learn about infrastructure and how do you get things done and incremental change and then some not so incremental change in the way that whole city is constantly rebuilding itself. I just found terrific, endlessly fascinating. Then I went to law school. After 3 years at the Parks Department, came back to New York City after that and practiced for a few years. I had worked at Parks with Edward Schuyler, who was the former deputy mayor for operations. In 2006, when the mayor asked Ed to become a deputy mayor, he called me and said, hey, maybe that opportunity's now. It's an opportunity. I was his chief of staff and counsel for 4 years and during the second term. That was a tremendous experience. That's where all those things, the 9/11 health, but overall operations of the city, I think we faced some really challenging issues, particularly in building safety. And there are just many areas. It really opens your eyes at that level to the intricacy of the inner involvement of city agencies. And at the end of the second term, once the mayor was reelected, because I was not planning on being here this long, but I thought, you know, if the right kind of opportunity is available, I certainly would be open to it. And I'd been working – DEP was in, is in the operations portfolio, and I'd been working closely with them. And ultimately, the mayor asked if I would take it on, and it's been a fantastic opportunity.
How does the city of New York manage its natural resources? We will ask Cass Holloway, commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Senate report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision-making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Brian Lewis. Cass, you mentioned earlier capital projects, and you have a number in your portfolio, and largely to meet state and federal mandates. Would you elaborate on the top three current projects that represent a significant investment in the future of New York City's drinking water system? And other than revenue collection, how are you financing these projects?
Well, I'm going to break the capital project priorities into two categories. There's mandated projects, and then there are non-mandated or discretionary projects. Mandated projects are, just to define those terms, if there is under the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act, which are federal laws, then rules get promulgated, and then the power to enforce those rules in most cases is then delegated to the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Meeting those rules is something that we're required to do. And in some cases, it requires massive investments, and there's kind of a one-size-fits-all approach to water quality regulation so that New York City, even if our water quality or that our particular circumstances suggest that, well, maybe a certain kind of investment is necessary to maintain public health and water quality, we have to do it anyway. Over the last 7 years, of the $19 billion that has been invested in our water and wastewater infrastructure, 69% of that has been dedicated towards meeting state and federal mandates. The issue with mandated projects is not necessarily that you wouldn't do the project unless somebody was telling you to. The issue is they're not only telling you what to do, they're telling you the timeline on which you have to do it. And that's created a couple of issues. Number one, if we have a state of good repair issue that we think ought to be dealt with before maybe a mandate gets completed, like a filtration plan or an ultraviolet disinfection plan, water rates are used to raise the funding needed to support the system. But the need to do a lot of these mandated projects at the same time has put a tremendous pressure on water rates. In fact, this year we had a 12.9% increase. It was the fourth double-digit increase in a row. That is because we are at a period of unprecedented development in the system. We have on the mandated side of things a water filtration plant that we're building in the Bronx, the Croton Water Filtration Plant, which is $2.8 billion. We're building a ultraviolet disinfection facility that is just south of the Kensico Reservoir. That's about $1.6 billion. We are completing a series of a massive upgrade to the Newtown Creek Wastewater Treatment Plant. The overall cost of that when we're done will be about $5 billion. And part of the reason for that astronomical cost is that we still have to treat the 240 million gallons of wastewater that flows through that plant every day while we are literally rebuilding it from the ground up. So the combination of time and then the infrastructure required to meet a standard has really put us in a place where, yes, we've raised water rates in order to meet these mandates, but you can only go so far. At a certain point, you have to just defer other investments. The financing of our operating and capital program is pretty simple. Water users are charged a rate for their water and their sewer use. And that rate has to be sufficient to cover four things. One is the cost of debt service, because all of our capital program, essentially with the exception of some money that is used for pay-as-you-go capital, but that's a very small amount, we float bonds to fund that capital construction. Then there's operations and maintenance costs. Our expense budget's about $1 billion a year. Then there is a payment that we make to the city, the so-called rental payment every year, which funds essential city services. And every major city in America makes this kind of a payment. Some call it an intergovernmental payment. We call it a rental payment. So there's that payment. And then finally, there's that pay-as-you-go capital piece. And we've had about $100 million in that category for the last few years.
Interestingly enough, you know, I just want to get a sense of, aside from the state and federal mandates that you are trying to fulfill, you folks would do this. It's a good thing. It's just the way they're telling you how to do it. But aside from that, how do you identify, prioritize, and allocate investment across projects? Could you give us a sense?
Well, this gets to those discretionary projects, yeah, because there are a number of projects that are underway. That probably the most single most important project is City Water Tunnel Number 3. The mayor recognized early on that this tunnel, which is going to give you the capacity to distribute that you need to turn off or shut down City Tunnel Number 1 and Number 2, obviously in a very planned way, to ensure that you can do regular maintenance and upkeep on them. City Water Tunnel Number 1 has been going strong since it was turned on in 1917. City Water Tunnel Number 2 has been going strong since it was turned on in 1936. So that's a long time without a break. So City Tunnel Number 3, now putting the tunnel in the ground is complicated, and then making sure you have the connections to the distribution network. We have about 9 or 10 projects going on simultaneously. Overall, how do we make this discretionary set of investments? Well, our operating bureaus up until the last couple of years had been identifying and keeping track of their capital assets and the investments that need to be made. But we also now are almost complete with a comprehensive asset management, development of a comprehensive asset management. I would call it a plan, but it's more of a tool. It's going to be a full listing of all of the agency's major capital assets. And in order to build our next 10-year capital plan, we're putting together business cases and packages of projects that will be based on what is posing the greatest risk, what do we need to deal with right now. So you're asking that question, and we happen to be in the midst of a kind of a transformation of the way that we do that.
So we've been talking about these mandated projects. In addition to the mandated projects, would you highlight for us some of the DEP's most critical investments in each of the 5 boroughs of the city and that ensure its water system is viable for the next 100 years? And maybe you can comment on what extent is the ARRA, American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, is that helping?
The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act is absolutely helping. We got $219 million in ARRA funding, which enabled us. We have 9 projects that are underway right now that otherwise wouldn't be underway. And a lot of those have to do with energy efficiency. And that's critically important. And it's a welcome return of the federal government into the funding arena for water and wastewater infrastructure. They've been largely absent from that field for the last 10 years. If you look at the history, and I had this prepared by decades, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the first decade of the new century, we basically peaked out at about $1 billion of funding from the feds in the 1980s. That was cut in half to $522 million in the 1990s. And over the last 10 years, it's been maybe about $44 million. So it really was a – New York City ratepayers pay about 99.9% of the costs. We are now doing substantial water main and sewer main investments in all five boroughs, but particularly in Staten Island and Queens, where we're still finishing building out parts of the water and sewer network. For Staten Island, we're also building a $250 million water siphon, which is going to be, really make the water supply to Staten Island robust. We have, I'm thinking through the boroughs, I talked about the Croton Wastewater Treatment Plant in the Bronx, in the Newtown Wastewater Treatment Plant in Queens. I think about things in terms of our drainage areas. We have 14 wastewater treatment plants. Right now, 7 of them, 50%, are under some form of major capital construction. So the project at Newtown Creek is $5 billion. There's $300 million worth of work happening at our Hunts Point wastewater treatment plant. Now, that's bigger than the budget of a number of city agencies. So it's a big program.
You know, you just mentioned doing work more cost effectively, and in general, just the troubling picture of city revenue. And I understand the fact that you folks aren't affected by the citywide program to eliminate the gap. But what are you doing to that end to manage your resources and your efforts more efficiently?
Well, it is true that DEP is since we have water revenues are used and almost exclusively dedicated to fund the capital work and the operations and maintenance of the water system, that is a dedicated stream. And so we are not within – when you have a program to eliminate the gap, we don't get counted in the same column of agencies that have to deal with that. And it's been very challenging. I think there have been 8 of those, and the commissioners have done a tremendous job working through those very challenging exercises and still delivering services. But that dedicated revenue stream is a blessing and a curse. I mean, if you need more revenue to build a plant that you need to build faster than you thought you did, there's only one place to go for it, and that's water rates. And in order to set water rates, DEP comes up with a proposal, and then I go out to all five boroughs and I have to explain what the proposal is. So I have a strong incentive for that proposal to be if it's going to be an increase, for it to be as low as possible. And I can tell you, having gone out and done that, I've now been around the boroughs twice since coming in January. First, just as a general informational tour, and then in this rate setting process where we did raise rates by 12.9%. It was lower than we initially forecast, but still, in this environment, any increase is very difficult for people. So what do we do to get control of costs? Well, there's the options. The first thing I asked our senior managers to do on the budgeting side was wanted to do an 8% across the board expense budget cut. It had been a long time since DEP, not that we weren't doing things cost effectively, but for exactly the reason that you identified, I think there just wasn't a sense that, well, can we do this? My sense was, I think we will be able to. And we were. And I think the credit of our managers, they've done a good job. 6,000 people sounds like a lot, but when you think about the magnitude of the infrastructure that is required to deliver water and treat wastewater, it's pretty far flung, and so it's a challenge. So that was one thing, and then we're in the midst of a project by project capital review, where we're looking both by doing this asset management tool and program, plus the project review, to say, well, what are we building? Why are we building it? When are we building it? And is there an opportunity to move, stretch, do things that will ultimately lower the burden or the need in the immediate future, so that next year, if there's an increase, it's as low as possible?
How is New York City ensuring its water system is viable for the next 100 years? We will ask Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept.
Moving to the Cloud, An Introduction to Cloud Computing and Government by David Wild examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in the States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Brian Lewis. Cass, you've mentioned throughout our conversation the proposed 12.9% water rate increase for fiscal year 2012. I know you've been around the city and trying to drum up support and justification for it. What have you done to enact any sort of benefits or assistance to folks because of this increase?
One of the programs – well, in his State of the City address, Mayor Bloomberg said that New York City was going to have the most ambitious program to help people try to avoid mortgage foreclosure. And so one of the things that we did to help that effort is created the Water Debt Assistance Program. And under the Water Debt Assistance Program, you basically, if you're in a situation where you feel like you have to meet certain criteria, but if you are in kind of imminent danger of being in a financial situation where you could possibly have your house foreclosed, we don't want people to be in the decision in a position of either paying their water bill or losing their home. So we set up a program where you're able to set that debt aside. It stays with the property, so it's not a forgiveness program. But then you enter a payment plan, and as long as you keep current, then you can either deal with that outstanding debt when you do a transfer, because it all has to be resolved if the house or the property gets sold, or you can come back and we can work on it together after you get back on your feet. Another way that we more generally have enabled to try to help with this is we've offered a 2% discount. In the initial proposal, it was 1%, and we were able to double it as a result of really some of the feedback I heard at the water rate hearings, where I presented the proposal and explained to people the basis for what the water rate was going to be. And if you sign up for our direct debit program online, you get a 2% discount on your water bill for this year. And we wanted to do that first to try to drive people to our website and to pay electronically. If you sign up for direct debit, I don't know about you, I pay a lot of my bills online and I like not having to think about it. So it's easy, and that is one of the reasons why we were able to we wanted to put that in place and see, and we'll see how it works. I mean, I think the mayor and Deputy Mayor Goldsmith are really fans of using technology to help people make their lives easier, make better decisions.
Collections and enforcement are integral to your department's operations. It is important to ensure that people who can afford to pay their bills actually pay. Would you tell us more about the innovative tools such as a water lien sale authority you're using to ensure revenue collection in a timely manner?
Absolutely. This is a critically important area because people, you said it yourself, if our goal is to ensure that people who can afford to pay for water actually pay. Because if they don't, that means that more that everybody else who is a good and paying customer has to pay either through raised rates in the subsequent year, and we want to try to avoid that. So what are the tools we have available? Well, traditionally, they had been pretty weak. Back in 2007, though, the mayor and the city council, Speaker Quinn, worked with us to give us lien sale authority for 2- and 3-family homes. So if you have debt that is 365 days or more old and more than $1,000, then you could be eligible to have that debt sold in a lien sale. And we found that just having that mechanism available, the vast majority of people either come in and pay their bill well before that sale takes place, or they enter a payment plan with us, and that way they have acknowledged their debt and they're working with us to deal with the problem. I think if you ask city council members, elected officials, and even our customers, they would give our customer service organization pretty high marks because we try to deal with people on a case-by-case basis and take everyone's circumstances into account. We want people to be able to pay, and so – but we also want you, like through programs like the Water Debt Assistance Program, to be able to make decisions that are going to optimize your ability to keep your house and keep the water flowing. So that's a tool. Now, interestingly, the lien sale authority expires as of this year, so we're working with the council now to continue to make sure that that continues, and we would even like to see it strengthened because the bottom line is it really is important for people who can afford to pay to pay.
Who does the water lien sale apply to?
2 and 3 family homes, and the criteria are you have to have debt that's been outstanding for a year or more, and it has to be $1,000 or more. And for single family homes, we don't have lien sale authority. We have water termination authority, which has existed for a long time. That is obviously a very powerful tool to be able to say to somebody, if you don't pay your bill, we're going to turn your water off. The reality is that it would be much more cost effective, and we would even be able to have a lot more crews on the ground dealing with catch basins and state of good repair issues than going out and going into the street and turning off people's water if we were able to get that lien sale authority extended to single family homes. So one of my goals is to work with the city council to do that, because shutting people's water off is not something we want to do. It's not something we like doing, and it also – it costs about $3,000 a home to do. So you end up spending a tremendous amount for a very little return, and you also do something that's extremely disruptive to a family.
It actually is interesting to me because that tack that you're taking sort of dovetails with the other tack you did with Jamaica Bay. It's the idea of let's be smarter about what we're doing here and pursuing this sort of direction.
Well, I think that that is right. What we're trying to do is show people the numbers. Mm-hmm. Look at this with me. I don't think this makes any sense. Do you? Here's a proposal that we think makes more sense. Can we work together to get there? And I think one of the concerns with lien sale authority or any authority that potentially puts you in a situation that could lead to foreclosure or anything like that is making sure that for the most vulnerable, you have programs available and assistance that you can provide. Things like the Water Debt Assistance Program do that. And I think if we're able to really deal with those issues so that people who can afford to pay. And those who need us to work with them, that we have mechanisms available and exceptions to do that.
You had mentioned the comprehensive sustainability plan for New York City that the mayor put out in 2007, and it outlines how the city is going to be greener and its operations more efficient. Would you elaborate on your department's efforts in making the city greener? What are you doing to be more sustainable?
First, Plan YC, which is the Mayor's Sustainable Blueprint for Sustainable New York City, sets these 127 goals for 2030. And right now we're in the middle of updating that plan. The city is in the middle of updating that plan. But I wanted to bring some experience into the agency because I think from my experience, this really goes back to the Parks Department and then going to City Hall, and now I'm at another agency. That if you're not in the agency, working with the agency management managers and having an ability to shape how operating and capital money is getting spent, then you're never going to really truly penetrate and make sure that things like sustainable construction practices or green infrastructure, for example, become a part of the way that the agency does business. Now, DEP is ahead of the curve on sustainable methods of dealing with things like stormwater. Probably one of our biggest water quality issues that the city has to deal with over the next 20 years is stormwater management. Because we have a world-class sewer system, on a dry day, the city's 14 wastewater treatment plants can handle 100% of the city's flow. Now, that wasn't the case 100 years ago, but where it went, and then there was a time when all of wastewater used to just go into the surrounding waters, and before that it was even worse than that. But now we have these 14 wastewater treatment plants, and on a dry day, it all gets treated. When it rains, if it rains a lot, you can have what are called combined sewer overflows, and we want to – the ultimate goal is to stop those. Now, there are two ways to do that. You can either funnel all of your stormwater to one of your wastewater treatment plants, or you can try to capture stormwater at the source. And for many years, decades, the approach has been to build what in modern parlance is called gray infrastructure, the big tanks that you put underground and spend a tremendous amount – cost a tremendous amount of money. Nobody ever sees them. And we've done a lot of that. But at a certain point, New York City is so dense that it's not cost effective to do that. So one of the things that I've asked Carter Strickland, our new deputy commissioner for sustainability, to look at is how can New York City start to bring into the mix a more aggressive green infrastructure approach, which basically says how do we capture stormwater at the source, either whether it's at buildings or in the street, and can we do that with infrastructure that is also going to have an ancillary public benefit, trees, parks, open space. Going back again to my parks days, back in 1996, we started the Green Streets program, and our goal was to have 2,000 green streets by 2001. Not sure if they hit that goal, but green streets are now as active as ever, and we're adding the elements to that infrastructure to be able to deal with stormwater over the long term. So this is a really exciting area. What it's going to take for it to be successful is an open-mindedness on the part of our regulators and the EPA and the State Department of Environmental Conservation to work with us because we think we can capture more, do a better job overall for water quality by taking a blended approach that does some of that classic gray infrastructure but blends in green. So we'll see what happens, but that's a top priority for the agency.
Cass, in the midst of the deep water oil rig catastrophe off the Gulf Coast, there has been interest in exploring natural gas drilling in New York watersheds. Would you tell us more about the findings from recent studies of this issue? What are some of the potential impacts of gas drilling to the watersheds? And to what extent is the current technology somewhat wanting?
Well, we've studied this issue closely. And so just to put the issue in context, there is a deposit known as the Marcellus Shale, which really covers a large part of the northeast of the United States. And through the development over time of technology and drilling methods, it's possible now to get into this rock deposit and to free up natural gas. Natural gas is a good thing. Natural gas supply is cleaner energy than and so as a general matter, we're in favor of natural gas. But the question is, how do you get it and where do you get it? And we studied this question because the State Department of Environmental Conservation put out an environmental impact statement because it's looking to establish rules in this area. And our research shows that the level of industrial activity that would be required to exploit this resource is such that it would really jeopardize New York City's water quality over the long term. And since we have right now, we're in a very unique situation. New York City does not have to filter the majority of its drinking water. The reason for that is because our source waters are so pristine. Now, the key to keeping them that way and what we are required to do is demonstrate a sufficient amount of control over watershed lands. And we do that by purchasing watershed property. We've spent over $1.5 billion, a lot of it under Mayor Bloomberg's tenure, to purchase watershed land and enter programs and partnerships with communities upstate. But when this proposal for drilling came out, we hired an independent expert because the mayor likes to do things based on data, not just that doesn't sound like a good idea, even though intuitively that's, the reaction that a lot of people had. A study came back and said, look, for every acre of Marcellus Shale that you're going to try to drill, you're going to have thousands of truck trips. You have to set up these well pads. You have fracking fluid that's proprietary chemicals that the companies that use them don't even like to disclose. You have to pump millions of gallons of that into the ground and then deal with what comes out afterwards. And a lot of it gets left there. And so the research said, given the state of technology, this is not something that is compatible with keeping our water unfiltered. And so we sent that to the state. And thankfully, the state came to the conclusion that for unfiltered water supplies like New York, whatever rules they come up with based on this environmental impact statement that they've done aren't going to apply, that you're going to have to do individual environmental assessments. And we think it's only a matter of time before the state comes to the conclusion that we've come to, which is this may be perfectly fine to do outside of an unfiltered watershed, but it's not okay to do in New York City's watershed. And just to provide some additional context, only 6% of the available Marcellus shale deposits in New York State are in the watershed. So that means 96% are outside of it, and we haven't studied that because we really kept it focused to the watershed. But that gives you some idea of, number one, not something that should be done in the watershed. And, you know, if the technology changes, we'll always be willing to look at it.
What does the future hold for the New York City Department of Environmental Protection? We will ask its commissioner, Cass Holloway, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management and Government, an introduction to earned value management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. And we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts in greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Brian Lewis.
So, Commissioner, what can you tell us about New York City's recent strong showing at the Best of the Best water taste test? What does such a feat confirm, and how do you ensure the city continues to excel in this area? Supply high-quality water from mountaintop to the tap?
Well, the award, we got second place at this year's Best of the Best water taste test at an annual conference. And that recognition really confirms for the country what we know to be true, which is some of the best-tasting, highest-quality water in the world is in New York City and is available every day to the 9 million New Yorkers who rely on it. Now, there's a tremendous amount of work behind that. That water quality is maintained through more than 500,000 tests a year. And what we are trying to do to promote it coming off of that victory, although we were number two, we want to be number one next year, but is we've started what are these water on the go partnerships. We created these portable fountains, which we're putting out at public spaces from now through Labor Day, in public spaces and at certain special events throughout the city, where people can come with their reusable container and fill up on water. Because our message is, New York City water is healthy, it's affordable, it's about a penny a gallon, if you're doing the math, and it's sustainable. You know, it takes about 1.5 million gallons of oil a year to produce all the bottles for the bottled water that are consumed in this country. And in New York City, the best water you can get is right at the tap. So that really was helpful to us in don't just ask us, take a look at this award.
It's a great idea to do that. It's interesting. You know, I talk to a lot of our guests about collaboration and partnership, and your mission, it can't be done alone. So how are you leveraging partnerships to improve operations and outcomes? And to what extent is collaboration and partnership driving innovation in your area?
Well, this is you're absolutely right that DEP does not act alone. And I think of a partnership and collaboration as how we work with our regulators, how we work with the many environmental stakeholders that we, you know, that care about what happens at DEP, whether it's locally in Jamaica Bay or overall water quality or Riverkeeper up in the watershed. But this is also a particular focus of the new Deputy Mayor for Operations, Deputy Mayor Stephen Goldsmith, which is to say public-private partnerships. What are the opportunities for the public sector and the private sector to work together to deliver whether it's helping to deliver a service or to help make an investment where the benefits are going to be better off doing that in that partnership than the city would be doing it by itself. And so we're really exploring with some of the unique assets that DEP has. We produce a lot of energy at our digester gas at our plants, and that can be converted to energy. We're looking in terms of partnerships with Con Ed. Are there things that we can do to take advantage or use that energy to feed it back to the grid? So that's a very fertile area that we're looking at. But partnership also means what I talked about with the water on the go stations. We have volunteers working with us at public plazas that Commissioner Sadiq Khan, the transportation commissioner, has helped create around the city. And as far as I'm concerned, wherever we can leverage some of the great things and creative things that the commissioners at other city agencies are doing, that the mayor's doing, the better off we're going to be. So partnership is a really important aspect of what we do, and I think it enables us to really get beyond what we would normally conceive of as DEP's jurisdiction.
I'd like to transition to the future. Going forward, what trends will have the most impact on your efforts over the next few years? And given your perspective, what emerging technologies hold the most promise for enhancing your efforts going forward?
In terms of the trends that will have the greatest impact on our agency, I think the top of the list has to be the regulatory trend. Where are we headed and in what posture with the Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department of Environmental Conservation? We all share the same goal, which is high water quality, high drinking water quality, and water quality standards that are going to enable recreation in our waterways. But there are a couple of different approaches to that. You can have an enforcement approach, which it looks kind of at everything individually, or you can say, looking at the context of the whole system, what is the basket of investments that need to be made over time together to both improve water quality but also make it affordable? And this is an issue that New York City faces alone. The EPA and State DEC have said some great positive things lately about green infrastructure and the willingness to work in partnership with places like New York City that have demonstrated a commitment to meeting water quality standards and to sustainable practices. But ultimately, the proof will be in the pudding, how we work together to develop the plans that we're in the middle of a planning process right now with our long-term control plans and some of the things that we have to put together for New York's harbor over the next 20 years, what those plans contain and the degree of flexibility that they allow is going to depend on that regulatory trend. So that's usually important. In terms of technology in our field, the wastewater field has lots of technologies in it, which really ties back to the regulatory trending as well. For example, nitrogen removal, and to give you two sentences on nitrogen, nitrogen is something that is a natural byproduct of the wastewater treatment process. It consumes a lot of oxygen, and because it consumes a lot of oxygen, that can have negative effects on aquatic life. So some of what we want to do with what's coming out of our wastewater treatment plants is remove the nitrogen. There's promising new technology that's enabling us to do that more cost-effectively, and we're going to do one of the biggest denitrification technology projects anywhere in the country at one of our wastewater treatment plants. That's underway, and that's really exciting. So in that area, that's critically important just to the bread and butter of what we do. how effectively can we treat, can we eliminate a step in the process which will save energy, save chemicals, and get water cleaner faster. And then there's the technology, things like automated meter reading that really can revolutionize our customers' ability to manage and make smart decisions about their water consumption and enable the city also to look at, well, what's the trending and, you know, how do we – where do we want to focus? Because I have a dual goal. One is to – the basic is to provide that healthy drinking water and the and to treat the wastewater. But also I want people to drink New York City water. It's a great product and the more people drink, the better we do. So it's a – I think that it's a technology is going to help us get there.
That's a wonderful perspective. You know, given our conversation today, I can tell your dedication and passion is there. I've really enjoyed this conversation. As you reflect on your public service, what advice would you give to someone who is thinking about a career in public service?
I think two things. One is, as you're starting out, get as much exposure to as many different things as possible, whether they're public or private. And the second thing that I would say to talk about these two together is I think it's a good idea to get public sector experience and private sector experience because if you're in one area or the other, it's interesting to me to, for people who have never been in the public sector who suddenly find themselves at a government agency and I've been able to recruit a couple of people who fit that profile. It's a whole – it's a totally different world in terms of how the government bureaucracy works. And that's not a negative. Bureaucracy there is just the reality. I mean, government is a bureaucracy. The by the same token, if you're in government all the time and you're not in the private sector and you don't have that bottom line pressure on you, then you don't necessarily appreciate the challenges that people face. And I think for me, now I was in private law practice and I've worked in city government, and it's a helpful perspective to know, that if you're in a place where you're responsible for helping to pay the bills. So now getting as much exposure as possible to different things, I think, is also important, whether that's in an agency and then going and doing something else. But don't just do one thing, because it helps you to figure out exactly how you want to serve. Having said all that, public service is terrific, and I would encourage everybody to give it a try.
Excellent advice. And I want to thank you for joining us today. But more importantly, Brian and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the city of New York.
Thanks again, Michael, Brian. And I just have to say, to get more information about the Department of Environmental Protection and our programs, Water on the Go, and the many things that we do and the things that I've talked about today, go to www.nyc.gov/DEP. And we have spent some time reinventing our site so that it's easier to navigate and has more information available immediately. I hope you'll go and tell us what you think.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. My co-host from IBM has been Brian Lewis. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thank you for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
What are some of the critical transportation challenges facing the U.S.? How is the Research and Innovative Technology Administration, or RITA, advancing an intelligent transportation system? What is IntelliDrive? And what role does technology play in making our transportation systems safe, secure, and efficient? Listen next week as these topics and more will be explored with Peter Appel, Administrator of the Research and Innovative Technology Administration within the Department of Transportation. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour.